Hello, you're listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Hello and welcome to Prof Talk. I'm your host, Farha Khan. UBC is home to a number of professors who are outspoken critics on public affairs in BC and worldwide, and who are not afraid of taking positions on such hot topics such as the HST or the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. Dr. Werner Antweiler is one of those individuals. He's an associate professor at the Sauder School of Business, where he teaches international business management and environmental management. He has been researching the effect of trade liberalization on the environment, the effectiveness of voluntary environmental programs, and most recently, the environmental benefits of BC's Scrap It program that provides incentives to scrap old polluting cars in exchange for new cleaner cars or public transit passes. His new course on environmental management was launched 2 years ago and follows an interdisciplinary approach that combines law, economics, engineering, and business strategy. It's all part of the Sauder School's expanding program in sustainability. Dr. Antweiler joins me now live in studio here in CITR. Thank you, Werner, for coming in today.
Hello, Farah. It's a great pleasure to be on your program today.
Let's begin with discussing the BC Scrap It program, which you recently co-authored a paper about. Tell us about the program. How does it work?
Well, a while ago, the BC government tried to motivate people to turn in their old cars and get cleaner cars as a replacement, because some of the old vehicles that are on our roads are quite polluting. They have a lot of emissions of carbon monoxide and nitrogen oxides and all of that. And so turning in these old clunkers and getting new cars actually makes a lot of sense if you care about things like urban pollution. And so providing incentives is a great idea to facilitate that process. So we actually tried to look at the question, how effective is this program in reducing emissions?
And so what did you find out?
Well, in short, when we started out, we were a little skeptical and thought, well, maybe this is just one of those programs where it looks great from the outside. When you look a little deeper, it's not much that's happening. But much to our surprise, we actually found that there is quite a lot to this program, that there are actually reductions of emissions. And that comes in part from a very particular feature of this program, which makes it unique in Northern America, namely, they not only provide incentives for getting a new car, but they also provide incentives for perhaps getting a bus pass or even getting a bicycle. So there is a considerable fraction of participants in this program that at the end of the day decides not to get a new car, but actually decides to get on the bus. And getting on the bus means you have a lot less emissions than driving even a clean new car.
So how do you calculate emission savings in the Scrap It program, and what kind of empirical research did you use when you did this research?
Well, that turned out to be, of course, quite tricky. And so one of the key questions we try to answer is, if you're turning in an old car, how long would you have driven it if you hadn't turned it in? So estimating sort of this residual lifetime of these old vehicles turned out to be really the crucial part of the analysis. Once you know that number, the number of years you kind of saved from still riding this old vehicle, the rest is easy. There are emission factors that tell you for each liter of gasoline you burn, how much carbon dioxide you're putting out, or for every type of car, we kind of have a very good idea of how much emissions of carbon monoxide or nitrogen oxide they're putting out, or volatile organic compounds. But the tricky part was really estimating this residual lifetime. And what actually turns out here in BC is that cars are typically a little bit older in BC than in the rest of the country. And so we scratched our heads and tried to answer that question. Now, why are cars older in BC than in the rest of Canada? And now we looked around and said, well, it's the weather. It must be the weather, because here in BC it's raining a lot and we don't have the cold weather and the salt in the streets as we have in Eastern Canada. So that is the reason why cars are a little bit older in BC than the rest of Canada, and that's the reason why the program in BC actually works better than it would in other parts of the country.
So as a researcher, were you satisfied with what you saw in terms of emission savings?
The magnitude of emission savings is actually quite considerable. The one thing that really stood out is that these old clunkers that are on the road that are 10, even 15 or 16 years old, some of them have really high emissions. And that is in part due to a change in technology. This is sort of the age of cars where they still didn't have electronics in the vehicles, and catalytic converters were not mandatory at that point. So there's been a lot of upgrading in cars and technology since then. And so when you get a new car today, the emissions that are coming out of a new car, with the exception of carbon dioxide, are a magnitude smaller than in one of these old cars. With carbon dioxide, it's a different story, and that's, of course, carbon dioxide is the gas responsible for climate change, and that is mostly driven by how much fuel you burn, and so fuel efficiency here really is the key factor. Now, as you probably all know, fuel efficiency hasn't improved all that much, simply because whatever savings you may have had in fuel efficiency has been wasted on getting bigger cars, and everybody's driving their SUVs and crossovers and what have you not, but it's a problem that we're all trying to figure out now, how to actually reduce our greenhouse gas emission from cars, and that's really a matter of getting more fuel efficient cars that are also maybe a little smaller than they are today. So that's a problem that this program contributes something to, because yes, newer cars tend to be more fuel efficient, and especially the hybrid ones. And what was really quite nice in this program is that if you got a hybrid car, you got a bigger incentive than if you got, say, an SUV. Even though the SUV is new and cleaner, but if you got the hybrid car, of course, then you would get a lot more savings because you had much better fuel efficiency.
Interesting. What was the percentage of people that opted for alternative forms of transportation, like transit or riding a bicycle?
That varied a little bit because there were four different phases of the program, depending on the funding they had available. But during the main phase, we got almost a third to about 40% of people actually choosing for the alternative options. And that was, on one level, quite surprising to us, because we thought this would be a very small minority taking that. But no, it's actually mostly people here in the lower mainland that actually saw value in making the switch. So we actually tried to figure out who is choosing which option, and what are the characteristics of people now choosing these among these different options. And we linked this to the census data. So we actually were able to control for different levels of income across regions, different socio-demographic compositions and age and those sort of factors. And what we found at the end of the day is that the one decisive factor is population density. If you live somewhere where population is dense, you have good public transit options. So if you live in downtown Vancouver or on the western side of the Fraser Valley, yes, you have a lot of options in terms of public transit. The further out you get and the lower the population density becomes, the less options you have in terms of public transit, and then these options obviously are not as attractive. So these programs in that sense make a lot of sense if you can target the audience, and targeting it to the urban driver actually makes a lot of sense, because they have the greatest incentive to consider alternatives if public transit is available. And as we all know, there have been some major investments because of the Olympics. There is the Canada Line now, and that has been a real success. There is some talk now of building this Evergreen Line, that I think the funding is sort of secured, and there's even some talk to build a UBC line. If you'll ever see that, I'm hopeful, but we'll see.
In another one of your recent papers, you study how much governments should focus their efforts on mitigation and adaptation in respect to climate change. Can you define these terms for us?
Yeah, so climate change, of course, is a hot topic. And I'm an economist by training, so I try to figure out what can I possibly contribute, because I'm not a climate scientist. I have nothing much to say about the science of climate change, but I can say something about now. What kind of programs are the most efficient in delivering results once we decide to go for a certain target? Now, that is where economists can contribute, and we can sort of look at the various policy options and say, well, what should we do? Now, mitigation and adaptation are really two options on the table. Mitigation just means reducing emissions through various means, fuel change, energy conservation, all these other options we have. Whereas adaptation just means kind of waiting and seeing what happens, and then basically adjusting to the negative consequences as they emerge. So one option, adaptation, is sort of a postponed option where we don't know exactly how strong the effects will be and we only decide to adapt in the future. Now, on the other hand, if we don't act now in terms of mitigating, of course, then we have the buildup of carbon dioxide and the consequences might be much more pronounced in the future. So we kind of have to make this really difficult trade-off in terms of those policy choices, wait-and-see approach, or do we go aggressively now and do something about reducing emissions? Now, to understand why different countries have different attitudes along that spectrum between mitigation and adaptation, it's very important to understand that the consequences of climate change aren't as global as the global warming may be, because the actual effects really are very localized. If you happen to live around the equator, or if you happen to live in northern latitudes or southern, very southern latitudes, the consequences are going to be different. Places like Canada are going to have a very different situation than, countries that are currently already under threat of not having enough precipitation, and they will even get less as climate change actually sets in. So depending on who you are as a country decides where you stand on how aggressive you want to go about climate change. And that explains in part why it's so difficult to come to a consensus internationally, why the Kyoto process sort of stalled, Copenhagen stalled. Now South Africa, when we had the last meeting, we didn't get much traction. Except for the European countries, there isn't a lot of uptake into environmental programs, green taxes, carbon taxes, and those sort of instruments or emission permit trading. So understanding the difference across countries understands why we don't actually can move forward globally. And the key players, of course, in climate change are the United States and China. And understanding their particular situation really helps a lot to understand why we actually can actually move forward more aggressively to reduce emissions. Now, so this research is also looking at a different angle, namely that climate change isn't linear, right? That it's not like CO2 concentrations are going up and then temperatures follow the sort of one-to-one. That sort of change is really quite non-linear. And why is that? Because there are all these sort of threshold points in our biosphere. For example, there is something called a thermohaline current, where there is this current in the Atlantic Ocean and the other ocean as well, that's basically transporting a warm water from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to Europe. And then it sort of circulates back through a different stream and now it circulates. Now, this conveyor belt can get disrupted, and it has been disrupted in the past. We have historic records, geological records, in part of what happened, and we know that those sort of things can get disrupted. Now, when exactly that will happen, how much CO2 concentration we have in the air where this tipping point will be reached, we don't know. I've looked through all the literature, and no climate scientist can pinpoint that number. So the big unknown in the climate change debate is, when do we reach those tipping points? And we're pretty sure they're out there. We don't know where exactly they are. And so therefore, we don't know exactly how aggressive we need to be to avoid getting to those tipping points. And depending on who you talk to, you get very different answers on how aggressive we should be. So the big problem in climate change is that there are these nonlinearities in this feedback system of CO2 concentrations to temperatures to these biospheric systems such as a thermohaline current. Understanding that is obviously quite tricky, and you know, I don't really can contribute much to that science part of it, but when I look at the available options from a policy point of view, I can understand why some countries are very keen on doing a lot. Now, if I was Bangladesh or the Netherlands, and I'm a low-lying country, and you know, I'm threatened by rising seawater, I want to do a lot, obviously. If I'm, let's say, Canada, actually, the consequences of climate change for Canada are going to be more benign because, well, it shifts some of the agricultural belt up north, but overall agricultural production isn't going to suffer as much as in some other parts of the world. So so there's a hesitancy factor built in from that point of view that the damages for Canada are going to be smaller than somewhere else. So there's obviously the big policy questions in the background. Now, what should Canada do? What can Canada do? Canada is a small country, but we've always have been a leader in environmental matters, at least until some time ago. And there's sort of this sort of good citizenship part of it that even if others aren't taking the lead, we can develop solutions. And in part, developing some of these solutions like carbon capture and storage can actually help us market those technologies. This is a real opportunity for Canadian businesses actually to innovate and take this also as an opportunity, not only as an obligation to do something, but to really take this opportunity and develop technologies that can be sold worldwide.
Now, tell us about some of the, some of the aspects of this new course that you launched a couple years ago, which may be of interest to the UBC or the wider UBC community. Tell us about it, and also tell us why it was important to make this course interdisciplinary.
Yeah, so there's a bit of history. Here on campus, we have one big problem. We're all part of individual departments and individual faculties, and we all have sort of this narrow view of we're doing our own thing. And trying to launch something that's more going across faculties is challenging because there isn't really a structure to make it happen easily. So if you're a student in engineering and you want to take a course in the business school, it's tough, actually, because sometimes there are prerequisites, sometimes there are other obstacles, maybe not getting the right credits, and your home program basically has to give you credit for the courses you take in the other program. Otherwise, you may find you don't have enough time to do this. So I've been struggling with this because sustainability is, by definition, interdisciplinary. It combines elements from a variety of areas. And so if you want to do a course in this area, you want to essentially make it transparent to students from other groups on campus. I'm in the business school, but I'd like it to be possible for students from engineering or from political science or from economics or from even other areas to take this course because learning about how to deal with environmental issues is, I think, an important part of the university experience. I think sustainability is an area that really now transcends all of UBC. You know, we're really trying to make it the university a living laboratory for sustainability. Now, every department, every faculty can contribute to that. And now at the Sada School, we have now since about 2 or 3 years ago, a concentration or a specialization in sustainability where our undergraduate and MBA students actually can focus on particular tools in those areas. Now, my course that's called Environmental Management is really trying to provide an entry point for business students to learn about all the various disciplines that are involved. Namely, the students are actually going to learn about environmental law. So basically, what is a legal context, constitutional, procedural? For example, there's something called the environmental impact assessment process that businesses need to be aware of. There's international trade law that has some relation in terms of what environmental treaties can and cannot do. And then there is environmental economics. So it's about the tools, how governments set environmental taxes or tradable permits or how they set standards, how efficient they are, what the trade-offs are, how businesses respond to that. Then we kind of need to look at how you do cost-benefit analysis. We need to look at how individual businesses do life cycle analysis of products, because if there's one thing that businesses need to learn, and that is that when you look at producing whatever it is you produce, you have a responsibility which is really cradle to grave, rather than you just produce a good, you sell it, and you're done. So this sort of comprehensive responsibility for your product is some overarching theme for businesses that they need to understand, that they need to develop, from green sourcing to looking at the disposal of the products, take-back programs. For example, if you're a car manufacturer, you want to learn how to design your car so that when they come to the end of the life cycle, you can easily disassemble them, recycle all the components that it can reuse, and make this efficient and make it worthwhile too, because you're recycling valuable materials. So in addition, of course, there's the engineering side to environmental management. And if you're working in a business that's producing, say, pulp and paper, you need to learn about the equipment that makes it happen that you reduce emissions, namely pollution abatement equipment such as scrubbers and gravitational settling chambers and electrostatic precipitators and the whole gamut of devices. It's a toolbox, and you need to know what's in the toolbox, even though you're not an engineer and you don't need to learn how these devices work exactly. What you do want to know is what is in the toolbox, what tools can you deploy for what kind of purpose, what are the various trade-offs environmentally versus economically, and basically what is the best way to deal with the environmental challenges that you face in a business context.
Is this course offered every year?
It is currently offered every year. It's now been taught the second year now. I'm still developing it. There's no real textbook out there, so I find it really challenging actually to collect the materials for students to have something that they can work with, because this is this sort of interdisciplinary material doesn't really exist. There are really great textbooks on everything from environmental engineering to environmental law to environmental economics, but they're all field books. So if you don't want to study each of those disciplines in great detail, what is it that it all connects to the business framework? And that is what my course is trying to contribute, you know, taking all these elements and putting it into the decision-making framework of a business. Where do I need it as an environmental manager in a firm?
I'd like to talk about how you are an outspoken critic on such issues, such as the proposed pipeline project. Why do you think it's important for you to share your expertise on important issues, such as the pipeline project, with the greater community?
Well, there is this great danger that when you're in the ivory tower, you're basically not reaching out to the community. It's very easy to get absorbed in your research, absorbed in your teaching, and forget about the greater context of you're living in a society and you can contribute to the society. And most of us academics are pretty shy people. And going out there and getting clobbered by the media or by opponents, it's hard, right? So it's not something people are very eager to do, because when you're reaching out and you're standing out and you're voicing opinions, and you have to be prepared that there are people who respond very aggressively sometimes because they don't like your opinions. And so growing that thick skin, I guess, is the biggest hurdle for most academics in being more outgoing and standing up for particular points of view. Now, I don't consider myself a radical, but I think I'm pretty moderate in my opinions. But that said, it's something where one can make an effort as an academic to contribute information to a debate, of getting consensus building going, because I think it's important as a scientist and as a researcher to get decisions back to the facts and the data, and let our decisions be driven by the best evidence there is out there. That's a scientific principle really applied to policymaking. And so I'm all for doing this sort of empirical research, doing this really rigorous study that helps us understand what is the best solution, and not just argue points, but really try to figure out from the data which policy works and which policy doesn't. And at the end of the day, we do get some answers, not always entirely satisfactory, but in many cases we do get good answers. For example, when it comes to looking at climate change, what is the best option to reduce emissions? Well, it's pricing the externality, it's pricing carbon. So putting a price on essentially emissions. How we do that, whether through a carbon tax or through a cap and trade system, and how we allocate the money that's raised through these channels, that one can discuss. But pricing the negative externality is the right answer. And so every economist agrees on that, essentially. We may have quibbles about now what might be then the best way to implement the pricing mechanism, but the pricing mechanism it is to solve the problem. Currently, of course, carbon isn't priced at all, except for British Columbia, where we have, in fact, the carbon tax. So everywhere else, there is very little in terms of pricing carbon. Australia is now experimenting with this as well. But there are very few jurisdictions in the world that actually are applying a price. And then the next question is, what is the right price? And again, that's where we need good data to decide what that right price might be. So, but getting out there and voicing opinions is, of course, important, I think, for an academic. And sometimes, yes, it's controversial. But at the end of the day, it's also about what I mentioned as consensus building, that you know, we have to find a solution that works and that is supported by a majority of the population. That's not always easy, because sometimes, especially when it comes to environmental issues, it's very easy to cast everything in black and white and not find a good solution. The pipeline project that's been proposed, actually two of them, one by Enbridge, it's called the Northern Gateway, and the other one by Kinder Morgan, which is actually doubling up an existing pipeline that's ending here in the Lower Mainland. They're good examples of a discussion we can have about should we build it? How are we allocating the benefits from this project? Is there any? How are we going to mitigate any environmental risks? How are we going to decide which of these projects actually is the better one? The trade-offs. And now, this particular project, of course, is much talked about. What I'm hearing from some quarters is they want to build this project really quickly, with so little concern for a wider discussion, and I'm alarmed by that, because I think it's very important to have this process, environmental impact assessment, to learn about the options that are out there, and not just say, well, this is a project, take it or leave it, but essentially what this environmental impact assessment process is about is looking at a project and saying, well, how can we improve it? Mm-hmm. And I think that is important. If we decide that we want to have this pipeline, if the federal government is gung-ho to support it, well, then still is the question, can we make it better? Is Kitimat the right place to end the pipeline, or is it Prince Rupert? Are there other ways how we can make it better? So conditional on whether or not this is being built, once it's being built, there is a question of how to do it right. And so these kind of questions shouldn't be lost in the arguments for or against the project overall, which is, of course, also a valid discussion we need to have in the first place.
Well, we're almost out of time, but so I'd like to really thank you for coming today. It's been wonderful to listen to you, and I may take your course. I've just been speaking with Dr. Werner Antweiler. He's an associate professor in the UBC Sauder School of Business. To learn more about his research, please visit strategy.sauder.ubc.ca. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. Prof Talk airs every Tuesday at 3 p.m. and features interviews with professors from a variety of disciplines. Next week, I will speak with Dr. Courtney Booker, who is a medieval historian in the UBC Department of History. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit proftalk.ubc.ca or email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'm your host, Farah Khan. Thank you for listening today.